The Word of Mouth podcast from NHPR is made possible with support from you, our subscribers.
And from Heinemann, a provider of resources written by real teachers for real classrooms. Heinemann values teachers as decision makers and students as curious learners. Discover the path to lifelong professional learning at Heinemann.com. Heinemann, dedicated to teachers.
You're listening to Word of Mouth, your questions answered, your state explored. I'm Hannah McCarthy, in for Virginia Prescott this week. There's a place in New Boston where you can't go. New Boston is a small town on the Piscataquag River, a half-hour drive from Manchester. It's famous for its annual 4th of July firing of the town's Molly Stark Cannon, perhaps the oldest cannon in the world still in use. Since 1942, the New Boston Air Force Base has been essentially off-limits to the public, almost 3,000 acres used for target practice during World War II and the Korean War. Unexploded bombs are still discovered there. Two were detonated as recently as 2011. But before World War II, before the nascent Air Force used Joe English Pond for target practice, it was farmland. 16 plots. Census records don't say what kind of farms, but the people here once raised sheep, dairy cattle, and hay. According to one New Boston historian, here the timothy, red top, and clover grew luxuriant. But in 1941, the Army bought those 16 farms for a song, like $23,200. And though there's a couple of places you can visit, you can camp and go fishing, the public isn't allowed on most of the base. And 164 years ago, somewhere along the farm road on the Air Force Base, in the shadow of Joe English Hill, a young woman named Servilla Jones was murdered. For our Only in New Hampshire series, producer Justine Paradise has more.
The cemetery in New Boston sits at the top of a hill, what was once the center of town. Now, it overlooks Main Street and the Piscataquag River Valley. But the cemetery still draws visitors, one gravestone in particular.
Servilla, daughter of George and Sarah Jones, murdered by Henry N. Sargent, January 13, 1854, aged 17 years and 9 months. And here's the famous little poem. Thus fell this lovely blooming daughter by the revengeful hand of malicious Henry. When on her way to school, he met her and with a six self cocked pistol shot her. That's pretty unusual to see something like that on a stone.
Yeah, the story of a death. Like, have you ever seen that before?
No.
No.
Not in this cemetery.
Lisa and Dan Rothman are New Boston residents and amateur historians. They're married and both volunteer at the New Boston Historical Society. This inscription on Servilla Jones's grave, the one that Lisa read aloud, refers to the story of her death in 1854. Just a quick note here, Servilla's name is spelled a couple different ways, but we think it might have been pronounced Servilla, not Sevilla, back in the day, so that's how we're saying it here. This story is one that appears in many New Hampshire history books, and even though it's been over 160 years, every few decades or so there's a new flurry of interest, another newspaper article, or, you know, a radio story. But despite the fact that Servilla Jones's gravestone marks such a well-known murder in the state, parts of her story remain a mystery.
I live right in the center of New Boston, and the cemetery is not 2 minutes from my house, right up on the Meeting House Hill, and it overlooks the village.
That's Caitlin Archibald. She's lived in New Boston all her life, and the story of Servilla caught her eye.
I thought it was interesting because you definitely nowadays would not see the name of the murderer carved into the stone. So it made me wonder who wrote it, because that's another thing I'm interested in, is that nobody knows who actually engraved the stone that she was murdered by the vengeful hand of Henry Sargent.
Right. Her memory is all about this horrible moment.
Exactly. And Henry is buried 100 feet from her grave.
Caitlin reached out to us because she wanted to know more about the deaths of Servilla and Henry. She'd already read a lot about the story because it's readily available online, thanks to the New Boston Historical Society, and mostly thanks to Dan and Lisa Rothman. They drew from historical census data and old newspaper articles to piece together what happened. And a few years ago, they were even asked to play the parts of Henry and Servilla in a historical reenactment of New Boston. Yeah, who was Servilla?
We don't know much about Servilla. She was the one of the younger children of George and Sarah Jones. We surmise she was a student, but don't know that. So we have very little detail about her. Henry, we know, was a woodsman, so he would go out into the forest and cut wood, and probably spent too much time living in his tent out in the woods. I don't know if that affected him.
Servilla's father, George, was a farmer, and he had a good estate worth $6,000. He died in 1853, just 3 months before she did, leaving Servilla, her mother, and her siblings, three brothers and two sisters. As the legend goes, Servilla and Henry were courting. But then her mother, Mrs. Jones, and a Mrs. Bartlett turned Servilla against Henry, and perhaps toward Mrs. Bartlett's son. We don't know his first name, at least not for sure. Henry was distraught. On his final evening, he stayed up, writing his last will and suicide note, late into the night.
Folks of the world ought to know that they ruined me. Once I'm better off in hell than I am here for the world to laugh at. I never should have got so tied up with her if she had not given me encouragement time and time again. And now see what you brought me. She belongs to me. And you know it. Boy, to the grave, better dead than a poor lovesick fellow. The world will not have Henry and Sargent for a laughing
ghost. Take warning by this.
I used to think that love would never hurt me.
Tears on my cheeks.
Death. Goodbye. Hypocrites.
Before he wrote this note, Henry had also spent weeks laying his plans, and apparently he didn't really even keep them a secret.
He'd actually made arrangements to have his grave dug in advance. He'd gone to Boston to acquire not only two guns, but also maybe a razor to end it all if the guns failed, perhaps.
We don't know whether Servilla and her family had caught wind of Henry's plans, but Henry does write in his note that he'd intercepted her at school before, but that she wouldn't hear him. It sounds like Henry might have been harassing her. But even if Servilla did know that Henry was dangerous, I don't know what she could have done. Her father had died a few months before, and with no police presence really to speak of, it's hard to imagine how she could have protected herself. So, on her last morning alive, Friday, January 13th, 1854, Servilla and her younger brother Plummer were walking to school. Dan and Lisa and I tried to retrace some of these steps on Servilla's last day, but you can only get so close. The whole encounter went down on what is now the New Boston Air Force Base, which you need special permission to visit. But you can still get a good view of the cliffs. The day we were there was bright and sunny, so we had to squint a little to look over the tops of the trees at those stony forbidden cliffs by Servilla's schoolhouse.
Oh, schoolhouse number three is Servilla's schoolhouse. She was on her way there. So she and her brother Plummer left their home, walked by Mrs. Sargent's home, and were on their way to schoolhouse number three in the shadow of Joe English Hill, and that's where Henry greeted them with his guns.
With her 15-year-old brother watching, Henry shot Servilla in the head 4 times, and then he shot himself.
She died instantly, and he did not. People heard the shots. They came to see what the problem was. The doctor came and was so distraught, so upset with Henry because of what he'd done, he refused to treat him, and Henry died a few hours later.
A lot of what we know of this story comes from the article in the newspaper, The Union Democrat, which was also picked up by the New York Times. The article published Henry's will/murder-suicide note, all 1,589 words of it. It also describes a visit to Henry's house where his body lay.
We saw his lifeless form. His face bore no indication of malice in his last hour, but rather of joy with having died by the side of the only one he could ever love. How bitter the tears, how poignant the grief of that family.
Yeah. But in the next paragraph...
Though near the house where Servilla lay a corpse in the house of her mother, we had no heart to enter another abode of sorrow.
Maybe the Jones family was too overcome by grief to talk, or maybe the reporter really just didn't visit because he didn't feel up to it. But whatever the reason, Henry gets to tell most of the story, and we hear very little, or nothing, from the perspective of Servilla or her family in this article. Who was Servilla Jones? Here's what we know. She's described as lovely and blooming. She was almost 18, and she was walking to school, so she was probably a student or an assistant teacher. Caitlin Archibald, the listener who wondered about Servilla Jones, she'd already read this whole story, even visited the grave. But what she really wanted to know went beyond the tale told in the newspapers.
It sounded to me like maybe she really was never involved with Henry, and that maybe he was just obsessed with her. As it reads from the articles and the research I've done, it sounds like the other gentleman who supposedly stole her heart away from him, he appeared overnight and he believes that the mother was conspiring, but it just seems to all be theory.
So I ran the idea past Dan and Lisa Rothman. But to me, so my theory is, I think that maybe she had maybe been interested, and then maybe she said, you know, maybe I'm not interested in this person, and started backing off, and he's projecting all of this. Like, why do we think that she proved false by bad advice? Maybe she just didn't like him anymore.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
You know?
Yeah, I don't presume to know what she thought, but in his mind.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But even just one thing that I'm interested in, too, is, you know, this article published his suicide note in its entirety. They visited his house, but they did not visit her house, and they did not get comment from her family. They just got comment from Henry's family. So to me, like, this is an interesting bit of reporting, too. It's, like, pretty biased. And they're saying, oh, he looked so peaceful, he looked happy at last, and, you know, had a lot of sympathy for him. So to me, I'm like, Sevilla's a little wronged here, you know?
She's a lot wrong. Is it sympathetic to Henry? Perhaps. He's not a sympathetic character, particularly.
I still wanted to see if I could find something real, a scrap or a whisper from Servilla or her family. So first, with Dan and Lisa, we tried finding descendants of her siblings, any living relatives. We searched genealogy websites and census records and found that the entire Jones family by the 1860 census moved out of New Boston. They'd left town and gone to Mount Vernon. But as far as we could tell, all those branches led to dead ends. But on one of the websites, findagrave.com, there's pictures of both Servilla and Henry. And Dan says that struck him as unusual.
I had trouble believing that in 1854, which is early days of photography, there would be these absolutely lovely miniature photographs of these two characters.
But then Dan reread Henry's letter, which again also serves as his last will. Henry lists his possessions and what should be done with them. And among them, he lists two miniatures. And then, writing to Servilla's mother,
I suppose you ought to have hers, although I paid for both.
So, maybe the picture of Servilla is really her. But the only copy is digital, from the Find a Grave website. And it's a crappy file, really poor resolution. Where's the original? Because of a complicated series of factors, including an untimely computer crash and just the passage of time, turned out this was another dead end. But there was one other thread, a place where we might be able to hear from Servilla's family. Dan told me there was a rumored existence of a letter, mentioned almost as an aside in a write-up on the grave from the 1970s.
So this is like third-hand information. Someone in 76 looking at some old file, talking to possibly Servilla's sister.
The Manchester City Library has archives of a number of old New Hampshire newspapers on microfilm. And after a couple hours, I found the letter from Servilla's younger sister. In July 1905, she'd written into The Union, a column called The Observant Citizen, in response to another letter writer who had wondered about that odd grave in New Boston.
Dear Observant Citizen, I saw in the Daily Union the verses that are on my sister's gravestone in New Boston Cemetery, Servilla Jones, who was killed by Henry Sargent on her way to school near Joe English Hill.
And then she goes on to say,
I have the paper, the Daily Mirror, that was printed at the time, which tells all about the tragedy. Sargent sat up the night before, making his will and laying his plans to meet Servilla on her way to school. It is a very sad story. and I am the sister of Servilla Jones, Mrs. Elnora Wynn.
Elnora. Half a century later, she still had the newspaper article. She was just 2 or 3 years old at the time, but she doesn't add anything or try to correct the record. So maybe the newspaper did get it right. Maybe Servilla had once been interested in Henry and then fell for Mr. Bartlett. Other readers also wrote in, a couple suggesting that it was Mrs. Bartlett who wrote that curious inscription on the grave, another writing that it was a Mr. Butterfield. But the author of the column, who just went by the pen name The Observant Citizen, evidently asked around too, and he wrote that the inscription was carved by the late Moses Davis in Nashua. The inscription on the stone was ordered by the mother of the murdered girl. Mr. Davis strongly advised her to leave off or modify the epitaph, suggesting that the future might change her feelings, but she insisted, and on the penalty of having the job done elsewhere, he performed the work. So,
thus fell this lovely blooming daughter by the revengeful hand of malicious Henry. When on her way to school, he met her and with a 6-self cocked pistol shot her.
Yeah, I mean, I wonder, I don't know if I would feel like I would want my whole life, you know, the symbol of my memory to be this horrible death, you know?
Mm. I agree. I would not have chosen that script.
Back at the New Boston Cemetery, Dan and Lisa bring me to one last grave, Eben Bartlett.
So we've spent some time here trying to find a Bartlett grave that might have been the young man. Short for Ebenezer Bartlett, born 1835, is about Sevilla's age. So is this the young man, the third part of the love triangle? We don't know.
A few years after Servilla died, Eben Bartlett married a woman named Abby. They had 3 children and were buried together in New Boston. If Servilla had lived, that probably would have been her life. But not necessarily. We still don't know the real story for sure. Maybe there was a love triangle. Maybe Servilla wanted to marry Eben. Or maybe she didn't. Maybe they would have had children. Maybe she would have taken care of her widowed mother, moved to Mount Vernon, and never married. Maybe she'd have become a nurse in the Civil War, worked in the mills in Manchester, become a school teacher. Or maybe none of those things. On our walk through the New Boston Cemetery, 164 years after Servilla's death, Dan Rothman pointed up the hill.
Over there is the town tomb. Is that familiar concept to you?
No.
So if you died today, we can't bury you in the frozen ground till springtime, so you'd spend time in the town tomb. After Henry shot Servilla, his dream was, his wish, as stated in his letter, was that he'd be buried side by side with Servilla. Of course, the family wanted none of that, but they did spend, they died in January, they did spend the winter together in the town tomb. That's a newer town tomb, but basically they did spend some time side by side.
And Henry did manage to link their names in historical memory. There's a poem called The Death Bridal, published in New Boston in 1854, which calls Henry and Servilla a dead man and his bride, and asks the reader to judge them not. But Servilla's gravestone refuses to refrain from judgment. If it's true that Servilla's mother, Mrs. Jones, insisted on the epitaph, it might change the way I feel about it. Perhaps she read the newspaper article and that horrible death bridal poem and decided that the epitaph on the gravestone was her way to set the record straight about her daughter. After all, in a way, stone is much more enduring than paper. I can imagine a way that Mrs. Jones decided that the headstone was the one place where she could have a voice and tell her side, where she could say, "This is not a love story."
That was producer Justine Paradise on the story of Servilla Jones. To see pictures of the grave and newspaper clippings and lots more, visit wordofmouthradio.org and help us keep reporting the story. If you are a descendant of a member of the Jones family, let us know. You can leave a voicemail at 603 513-7796 or email wordofmouth@nhpr.org. We're also looking for that 1854 Daily Mirror story on Servilla's death, the one Elnora mentions in her letter. If you have a tip on where to find a copy, please get in touch. Coming up, a conversation with Paul Tosi about a landmark court case in the LGBTQ movement, right here in New Hampshire. Stay with us. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Hannah McCarthy in for Virginia Prescott this week. Among the landmark events in the struggle for gay rights in the U.S. was a case right here in New Hampshire. Homosexuality was often villainized and misunderstood in 20th century America.
There may be some here today that will be homosexual in the future. What would this do to your mother or father? Think about it. And you will be caught. Don't think you won't be caught. And the rest of your life will be a living hell.
That's a warning to a group of Florida high school students in the late 1960s. But it was also a time of intense activism. The civil rights, women's rights, and anti-Vietnam War movements were changing the conversation. And in 1969, the three-day Stonewall riots brought national attention to the fight for equality. And in 1971, Paul Tosi started as a freshman at the University of New Hampshire. He's one of the subjects of a new PBS documentary coming out, part of their series, We'll Meet Again. In the episode, Paul revisits his time in college and his role in the New Hampshire Supreme Court case, the Gay Students Organization of the University of New Hampshire versus Bonner. The show also follows his journey to reconnect with the founder of the Gay Students Organization, a fellow UNH student named Wayne April. April's example made a big impact. He inspired Tosi to stand up for his beliefs and live honestly. But over the years, they lost touch. So in this episode of We'll Meet Again, Tosi set out to find him. Last week, Virginia Prescott caught up with Paul Tosi about this powerful moment of political and personal change.
Paul, welcome.
Thank you.
So you were 18 years old when you arrived on campus. What did you know about the world then, a lad from Portsmouth, New Hampshire?
I knew very little. I had really led quite a sheltered life. I had came from a wonderful family. I attended St. Patrick's School in Portsmouth and then St. Thomas Aquinas High School in Dover, New Hampshire. And I was really wide-eyed when I got to UNH. I wanted to study political science. I had every intention of having a career in politics. And so when I went to the University of New Hampshire, I was seeking to expand my horizons.
So the documentary is about looking for people who played an instrumental role in a person's life. You were trying to find a man named Wayne April. Who was he?
Wayne April was another student at the University of New Hampshire, and in 1973, he formed the Gay Student Organization. At the same time, I ran for and was elected student body president of the University of New Hampshire, Durham campus. And Wayne's organization had to go through a committee that came under the jurisdiction of the student government, the Student Organization Committee, to be approved. They met every rule, every regulation, every document they had that they needed, they had, and we approved them. And I met for the first time gay men and women. I really had had no interaction prior to that.
How many people were in the organization at that time?
There were, surprisingly, there were probably over 20 members of the organization at its inception.
And this is back in 1973 at that point. So it was then that the gay student organization at UNH got the attention of the governor, Meldrum Thompson. What happened? What was his response? This is a famously conservative governor.
very famously conservative. And his response was very famously conservative, backed up by the Manchester Union leader. The governor called for the expulsion of the sexual deviants and perverts, and the Manchester Union leader chimed in with a front page editorial, "Boot the pansies out."
Wow. So how did the university respond to that?
The university responded, the Board of Trustees met, and fortunately for the gay student organization and for all of us, the chairman of the Board of Trustees was Mildred McAfee Horton, one of the most outstanding women of the 20th century in the United States.
Bring us back to that scene, though. What did you say?
You know, I consider it to be my 15 minutes of fame in my life. I rose. It was in the New England Center. The board meeting was in the New England Center, and I rose to speak. Mildred McAfee Horton recognized me. I was surrounded by members of the gay student organization. And she listened intently as we defended the gay student organization based on the First and the 14th Amendments to the Constitution and based on the fact that they deserve the same civil rights, the same human rights as anyone in our country. And I believe that these people had every right. And the further along I went and the more that I was exposed to these people, I realized that I shared something much more than my desire for equality for everyone, that I was also fighting for my own equality.
So you had a sense that there was more to it for you personally.
Further along I went, the more I realized that I had been repressing my sexuality for years. And by the time this one-year battle was drawing to a conclusion, I came out to the people that were most important to me.
What was the response?
Acceptance. There was a phone call I had with my father, and my father never used the telephone. My phone rang one night, and he was on the other end, and I was stunned that he was calling to find out what I had planned, what I was going to say. And he wanted to know, honestly, he said, tell me why you need to do this and tell me why you are committed to this. And I talked to him about the First and the 14th Amendments. I talked to him about the right for all men to exist equally. And his response to me was, we support you 100%. Know that in your life, if you lead your life with that as a rule, that you will always do what you feel is right in your heart, you will have a productive, wonderful life that you can be proud of. That phone call said to me that my family was open to whatever path I followed. And that gave me the ability to continue along the path and to the announcement that I was gay came at the end of this journey in the mid-70s, 1974.
So they upheld the right of the GSO to exist on campus. But after that, Thompson made his intentions clear. He wrote to the trustees, either you take firm, fair, positive action to rid your campus of socially abhorrent activities, or he's going to stand solidly against the expenditure of one more cent of taxpayers' money for your institutions. So he said, you do what I want, or I'm taking away your budget. And eventually they did cave.
Yes, they did, and which resulted in the lawsuits. It's kind of like there are two segments to this. There was the spring of 1973, right after the organization was approved by the university, and that's when the Board of Trustees had two votes supporting it. We then went through the summer where the governor just kind of that marinated in the governor's mind, I guess. And then in the fall, there was the first dance. The gay student organization had a dance, and then they had a play. They sponsored a play, and that's when the governor exploded, and that's when the court cases erupted. And in the fall of 1973, they proceeded to build a case based on the fact that homosexuality was a disease. December 1973, the American Psychiatric Association removed homosexuality from its list of diseases. I don't think that's coincidence. And the university's case fell apart.
That's fascinating.
I had a wonderful discussion with the law librarian at the State Supreme Court Law Library this summer.
Yeah, I saw that. I wondered what was it like to go back and leaf through the court documents of this case, Gay Student Organization of New Hampshire versus Bonner.
It was fascinating because the decisions written by the judges were so simple. They were absolutely so clear. And I think that in the end, that's why there were no further appeals once that case came down. And that's why it laid the groundwork as a cornerstone for cases to come, because it is simple. It was as simple as you grant one right to one person, you grant it to all. Can't argue with that.
What else was happening in the world, you know, at that time in this movement?
Very little, really. I mean, this was, you know, Stonewall was 1969. And, you know, understand, one of the things about this series and this show, We'll Meet Again, and featuring this issue at this particular time, shows you the difference between now and 50 years ago, 44 years ago. Stonewall was 1969, and it was a landmark moment in LGBTQ rights. But it was only a seed. And it took years. And what we did in 1973, nobody really publicized the court cases that resulted from that governor's stand. It took us, that was another seed. And basically, 35 years later, we fought for more equality. We fought for gay marriage. We fought for all kinds of gay rights. We went through the AIDS epidemic in the 80s. To get that message out to the entire country, and it was decades worth of work.
We don't want to, Paul, give away the documentary, but yours is not the only story that's told there. There's another man. He's from Connecticut. He was terrified of being gay when he was growing up. In fact, he was sought out psychological help, and he was going to get shock therapy, electroshock therapy, when he told a friend who assured him that it's okay, I accept you, I love you as you are. So his life could have been dramatically different. So if somebody comes out to a person for the first time, what would you advise them? What do they say? How should they respond?
That today, it's a new world. It's a totally different environment. Be proud. Be strong. Be the best person you can be. Because you will just by doing that, prove to people that you are no different. You're no different than any neighbor. And I had that exact experience here.
What happened?
Where when my partner of 36 years, Joe LaRosa, we were married on our 27th anniversary in San Marcos, California, because it was the first opportunity we had to get married. And when we moved to Ocala, Florida, one of our neighbors came out and said, "When are you getting out of here? We don't want your kind in our neighborhood." 6 months later, that same neighbor came up to me, and I was like a little taken aback. She hugged me. She said, "I was wrong. You're no different than any other neighbor. You're good people. I want you here. And I apologize." I had done nothing other than my day-to-day life, the activities that Joe and I have always done, the organizations that we have always participated in. You make a difference by leading the life that you want to lead, that is in your heart. And so someone coming out today, you can't hide it. It's what Wayne April saved me from. If I had not met Wayne April, I might have gone down a path that was all too familiar to those of us brought up in the 60s and 70s. Gay men that hid their sexuality entered into heterosexual relationships, married, had children, and 20 years down the road, came out to a family and in many, many cases destroyed lives. Wayne April saved me from that.
But what is it that he gave you permission to do? What was it about him?
Because of his actions, because of the gay student organization, and the determination that they showed me that I did not have to repress my sexuality, that I could admit to myself the person that I was, and I could go out and accomplish great things. The most important thing to me has been the relationship that I've had for 36 years, going on 37. We've had a wonderful life. We've lived all over the country. And everywhere we go, I think everywhere we've been, we've made a difference.
That was Virginia Prescott talking with Paul Tosi. He's the subject of Coming Out, an episode in the PBS documentary series We'll Meet Again, hosted by Ann Curry. You can stream the series online at pbs.org through March 27th. Up next on Word of Mouth, the passing of the gavel and a visit to the town hall in Deerfield, New Hampshire. Deerfield, this spring marks the passing of the gavel. After decades of serving as town and school moderator, Jack Hutchinson is stepping down. Town moderator is a unique role, intrinsic to the small town meetings and direct democracy found in New Hampshire since the state's earliest days. The moderator runs town meetings and makes sure that elections run smoothly, but there's more to it than just being a good speaker and knowing Robert's rules. Our producer, Justine Paradise, went to Deerfield for a visit with Jack Hutchinson at the town hall.
Jack Hutchinson got started moderating not long after he moved to Deerfield in 1976. At the time, he was working as a second grade teacher, so he started going to school board meetings.
And there was a year when there was a weak moderator. And the meeting can get very uncomfortable and unpleasant really quickly if you don't manage that people not attack each other, that they be civil. And that happened in that meeting. He was a very good man, but just not born to be a moderator.
Jack saw how much of a difference a strong moderator could make. So a few years later, in 1983, he stepped up himself, and he was fortunate enough to have a mentor.
Jim McIntyre was the moderator before me, and he was really good, cheerful, but very much in control. He was a senior 747 pilot for TWA. And when I was his assistant, every year we'd meet at his big farmhouse and go over Robert's rules together, even though he'd been doing it for years at that point. I remember once in a meeting I started to get involved in the issue, and he passed a little, ripped off just two lines of a yellow pad and passed it to me and said, "If someone asks what time it is, you ask if someone has a watch." You don't know anything. So it was hard the first years. You know, I would read Thomas Jefferson. I'd go in the woods and read Thomas Jefferson and read Robert's Rules and try to get myself in a mode of practicing democracy well. But now I just bring my books in the morning. I'm good to go. It's been a long time, you know.
The town moderator is responsible for making sure elections go smoothly and for running town meetings, or deliberative sessions, for those towns who have made the switch, as Deerfield did in 2005. Depending on how many elections there are in a year, a moderator might put in 20, 30, 40 hours annually. It's an elected position, and it's paid, but barely.
So if I work 15 hours for an election from 6:30 in the morning till 9:30 in the evening, or whatever, 15 hours, I'll get a check for $100.
Minimum wage job.
Yeah, it is minimum wage.
There's a lot of behind-the-scenes work, testing machines, preparing ballots and forms. And before town meeting, Jack says he tries to talk with everyone who submits an article for the warrant. That's the list of proposed motions on the agenda, which can range from several million-dollar budget items like building a new fire station, or small things like minor zoning changes in a residential neighborhood. Jack says he'll help anyone in the town through the process of writing and filing a motion. And he tries to stay neutral, keeping his own opinion out of it.
It sounds kind of like a lifestyle rather than just a position that you fill once a year.
It is a little bit, because it is true that in other areas, I'm also careful not to take strong advocacy positions while I'm moderator. I think one of the core things that's going on when you're moderating, when you're in this role in any society or organization, is that people really need fairness in things they do, or they're really attracted to it, that it's important to us, that it's common for children to say that's not fair when they feel it's been violated. So it's in us. It's not just taught to us. It's in us, this desire for fairness. And that's what you're doing, is you're tapping into that as a moderator. And when you do that, everybody feels good about it, and you build a sense of respect for each other and listening to each other, because people enjoy engaging the fairness, or most of them do. A few probably don't, and you have to work a little harder with them, and you have to manage them a little. But a lot of people really like that, and they adopt that way of talking. When people feel like the meeting has been fair, they're more likely to accept the result, even if it's not what they thought going in, to understand this is the will of the group.
So some of this sense of fairness that you're trying to cultivate, like, what does that look like at a meeting?
What it means is that you're patient, that you give each person a turn at the microphone. If they're struggling with something, you help them. If they're trying to make a motion and they're not sure how to do it or to amend something, you help them word it. You take a recess to support something. If they have a question, you answer it directly. You don't allow anyone to step on anyone else in the meeting. You're really firm about control of the microphone and who's speaking. And you're always diffusing tension in the way you use your voice and the way you respond to people. You protect everyone from having anyone cheer for anything or boo up for anything or anything. Just ask people to realize that there are people who with equally strong feelings on the other side of this issue, and we're going to treat them respectfully here today. I open meetings with a meditation now, and I think it helps set the tone, you know, just recognizing that we're here together to decide the business of the town for the following year, and let's work together to do that and come out a healthier town than we came in.
Well, was there ever a time when things went like dreadfully awry, or any mistakes or meetings that are memorable in that way?
There was one time when I had to have, or I decided to have a resident, a voter, removed from the hall because she was just challenging my authority too much. And you have the right to do that as a moderator. And so I just asked the police to escort her out of the hall. But other than that, there's been times when I've stopped to consult with people, but I don't remember. You know, there's been times when people have reminded me, wait, that's not on the amendment. I say, oh, wait, okay, good, thank you. But never totally off the rails, no, mm-hmm. No.
Even if he does feel passionately about an issue, Jack says it's important not to show it.
Not only do I not show it, I don't feel it when I'm in the hall. Except one time I remember when we were in this hall, the town hall, and we had 200 people up here, 300 people downstairs. It was a school district meeting, and there was a bond issue to build a new school. And we needed a new school. And I'd been a teacher in this town. And I knew we needed the school. And it passed. And I was in front of the hall downstairs, and Kathy Berglund was up here. We had a microphone between us. This is like 1988, 1989. There's no video link. And I was in front of the hall, and I went, yes, like that. to the side, sort of. I sort of hit it, but I was so pleased when I counted those votes, and we got 2/3, which is what we needed for a bond issue. And the school was going to be built.
Years later, Jack was moderating another town meeting when a tense issue came up. It was the designation of a local road. There were some people who wanted to make it a scenic road and others who didn't, who wanted to keep it the same. He had tried to get the two sides to talk to each other before the meeting, but that hadn't worked out. But then, as the meeting was getting started, everyone was finally in the same room.
One of them approached the other And I saw that happening. I went over to see if I could help with anything, but I didn't need to.
They started talking. One side conceded to the other, and it was voted through easily. And it just so happened that there was someone in the audience who was a newcomer to town.
I didn't know what I was doing there. I just figured I'd just show up and see what happens in this New England town.
That's Dan Holdridge. He'd just moved to Deerfield, and this was his first town meeting. And he watched the whole thing, this whole debate about the Warren article and the scenic road.
And I just sat back in awe, and I'm like, whoa, this is what democracy is. This is how that works. And But the gift of it was what was happening without anyone saying. And that's what Jack put in front of them. Here's the carrot. If you guys want to have an experience of democracy like you've never could imagine, chew on that carrot. And sure enough, they did, and they came back with something awesome. And that's when I was like, whoa, that would be pretty awesome to do.
Dan is the CEO of an electrical engineering company, and he's also a keynote speaker. He travels around the country giving speeches about surviving 9/11. And the next time he ran into Jack, he told him how impressed he was.
I said, I've seen a lot of people who can try and think that they can talk in front of an audience and bring people together. That was just what happened. That was a master at it.
Jack will be 70 on his next birthday. And when Dan approached him, he was ready to pass the gavel. It isn't easy to find people willing to do the job.
I remember that. So for several years, I'd been asking at town meetings or school meetings if there was anyone who wanted to take this up, because I was ready to pass it on to somebody else. And no one wants to do it, you know. It's not an attractive job. Partly, you can't participate in stuff, and most of the people who come want to participate because now you have to be neutral. But when Dan came so enthusiastic, it was the first time we met, and he was interested. And so I talked to him about it a little. But then when I went home, I checked him out. You know, I called around.
People vouched for Dan, and he passed muster. Even though he's been in Deerfield just 3 years, Dan decided to jump in. He's been going to state trainings, going over to Jack's house to study Robert's Rules, the guidebook for New England town meetings, and serving as assistant moderator. On a recent election day, that meant prepping the forms and ballots as usual. But when a snowstorm blew in, it also meant shoveling the steps with Jack.
We were at it. I mean, my back was sore the last couple. And they're like, what were you doing? Town moderator work, you know? All these things that Jack's taught me, there's so many things that I'm processing now, which I know over the years, you know, hopefully be able to do it for many years. It'll get better because I'll know exactly what to hit, listen for. And if I hear a cue, I know that's going to trigger me to say something or not say something. And to know when to end a discussion versus letting it go further, you know. I think this first, this deliberation session this past time, I leaned over to Jack and said, is now a good time? No, let them hear it out a little bit more. You know, it's hard, and there's so much more to it than just reading a Warren article. You've got to really appreciate each citizen, what their coming with their concerns are, what their challenges, why they went around and got 25 signatures to bring something to a ballot. There's something really powerful to that, and you need to appreciate that. You got to show it in how you speak to them.
Dan says he plans to open his first meeting with a meditation, the same meditation that Jack's been using for years. And as for Jack, he plans to keep up one tradition. Every election, the Women's Club in Deerfield serves sandwiches at the polls.
So every election, I make 5 or 8 loaves of bread and bring them down fresh that morning. And they cut them up and make all the sandwiches. Or not. People are asked, would you like moderator's bread or commercial bread or something? And a lot of them take moderator's bread. Wow. So it's part of our little town. And I'll keep doing that, you know.
I didn't get the recipe yet, so that was one thing I didn't pick up yet.
The election is coming up on Tuesday. Dan Holdridge is the only candidate for town moderator on the ballot, so barring something completely unexpected, he'll be elected Deerfield's town moderator this week. That's it for Word of Mouth this week. A giant thank you to the New Boston Historical Society, especially Dan and Lisa Rothman for their research, and David Woodbury. Also, thanks to the New Hampshire Historical Society, the New Hampshire State Library, Mary Jo Marsley at the Mount Vernon Historical Society,
the Manchester City Library, the Beinecke Rare Book and Manuscript Library at Yale University, the Goffstown Library and the Goffstown News, the 50th Space Wing, Leslie Butler at Dartmouth College, and Becky Rule. And a special shout out to Todd Bookman, Maureen McMurray, and Nick Capodice for reenacting the voices in Servilla Jones's story. This episode was produced by Justine Paradise with help from Taylor Quimby, Jimmy Gutierrez, and Ben Henry. Erica Janik is our executive producer. Maureen McMurray is administrator of undiscovered deep sea gas vents and associated novel ecosystems. Music in this episode from Ikimashu Aoi, Poddington Bear, Aaron Zim, Ari De Niro, Jazar, Broke for Free, and Blue Dot Sessions. I'm Hannah McCarthy, in for Virginia Prescott. She'll be back next week. Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.